Good morning, everybody. And it's a privilege to be able to speak with you here today. My paper is really looking at, my question is the biblical Jesus a resource for appreciating the dignity and integrity of women and for taking a transformative stance against oppression against women? And I'm going to kind of refer to some biblical texts to say yes to that question. He is a resource. And then we'll have a bit of an exchange, a bit of a conversation about these points. So it's quite clear from very early on that the biblical Jesus is countercultural where the situation of women in his time was concerned. For example, you know, you have the story of Jesus and the Samaritan woman, where he gets into a conversation in a public place with a woman. And in his time, that was very countercultural to do as a man. And you see the cultural view in his disciples who arrive on the scene to say, my goodness, he's talking to a woman. But Jesus, for him, this was not a problem. But clearly for them, it was something kind of unusual. And we know then through that he's been countercultural in that biblical scene. Similarly then, we have Jesus being kind of very heroic, if you like, in the story in John 7:53 to 8:11. Where you have the story of the men attempting to stone a woman. And, you know, they're trying to catch him out, as they say in the story, by trying to bring this situation before him. But he, of course, turns the tables on them and prevents that from happening. But the very fact that they tried to, if you like, use a woman, it was a way of showing that he obviously was known to be somebody who had a strong stand for women. And they thought this was a way then to show, if he was to say, we must be against the stoning of the woman, that would be going against the law of Moses, which seemed to call for that. And so they're trying to see if they can trap him by kind of getting him to go against the law of Moses. But he turns the tables against them. So again, it's another sign that he's being countercultural. He's prepared to stand up for this woman, even against the religious tradition, which seemed to support the idea of what they were looking for from him. And of course, we have no idea whether she actually was in adultery or not. That was the charge. And of course, where is the man if she was? Anyway, so again, that's another illustration in the Bible of where Jesus is at around the situation of women. And it's positive, obviously. Then you have stories like, say, the story of Mary of Bethany with Jesus coming. Jesus arrives at the house of Lazarus and Mary, who was his sister, and Martha to another sister. And it was in those days, you know, when a man arrived into the house or a woman arrived into the house, it was customary for their feet to be maybe washed and cleaned because of the kind of dusty roads that had walked in. It was just a nice way to welcome the guest. And we can presume that Mary probably washed his feet a number of times on these visits. And so there was that connection there. But that day she wants to kind of express to him her desire to be a disciple. And in his culture at that time, for a male rabbi, teacher, to have women disciples was not really accepted. But again, for Jesus, this is perfectly acceptable. She wants to be, if you like, a disciple, to learn from him as a male teacher. And he accepts this against the culture of the time. And Martha shows the cultural view when she says to him, you know, Lord, will you tell my sister to come in here and help me prepare the food for the three of us? And he says, no, he doesn't go along with that. So he says it's perfectly fine that she wants to be a disciple. And we're talking spiritual conversation here. But again, it's an illustration of his countercultural stances regarding the situation of women in his time. Then you have illustrations of him, say, for example, talking about the experience of God through the life of women. For example, the woman in the lost coin, Jesus tells that story to illustrate for his hearers that this is a way to understand how God is working in the world. This woman, it's her precious coin, she's lost it, she's really anxious to find it and the efforts she'll make to do so. And we know very much the story of the parable of the prodigal son and all that story, but this story is not as well known, but that too is there, that story too is there. And this is a story about God working in the world like a woman. And for Jesus, again, you know, to think in those terms would have been countercultural, to be trying to tell his hearers about how God works in the world through looking at the situation of women, the experience of women, and saying it can be revelatory of God. And you have the story of the baker woman God, the woman making bread. And again, Jesus is saying that God can work in the world like this woman making bread. because she's somebody who's doing something that's important for the society, but again, it wouldn't have had high status. And sometimes God's work in the world is work like that that may not be fully appreciated, and yet it's important. This is not the warrior God of the Exodus, for example. It's a very different kind of God that's being told there in that story then. And then, you know, you have Jesus identifying himself in female terms when he speaks about himself and his care for the situation in Jerusalem. He talks about himself as a mother hen caring for her chicks. And this is a way of being able to say, you know, that he can enter into a woman's way of being. And as a man, this is not a problem for him. Whereas for some men to think about themselves as a woman would have been very countercultural, of course. But the story I want to kind of, if you like, give a bit more attention to this morning is the story in Luke 13, 10 to 17, which is the story of the stooped woman, as she's often called. And that's a story where it's a synagogue that they're in, and it's the Sabbath day. So again, very religious sort of atmosphere around this story. And Jesus comes in to give a teaching, as it's called in that story, that day. He's been asked to give a teaching in the synagogue on the Sabbath day. But instead of going ahead and doing that in the way that was expected, he notices this woman with an infirmity. She's stooped over like this, and she's been this way for many years. And for him, you know, he can't go on and give the teaching he was asked to do until he addresses that situation. So he calls the woman forward. Now, that was a difficult thing, perhaps, for her to come forward into a public setting like that with her infirmity made very, very apparent. But therefore, we have to ask ourselves, why would he do that? Because it seems on the surface to be a story just of a single woman with a physical infirmity. But I think if we read the story in more sociological terms, Cecil Wright Mills talks about the sociological imagination, where you look at personal challenges in their social context and how the social context is helping to create the personal challenge. And the woman's personal challenge of being physically infirm and all that would have meant for her going trying to manage in life like that, that behind it then is a whole culture for Jesus, I think it can be said, that he's seeing her story and her situation as an expression of the culture and the society. When I was in Ethiopia many years ago, one of the first things I noticed was the women carrying bundles on their backs and, of course, the water jars as well. And they're stooped over like this, carrying those goods. And they're, you know, they're going down hills and on streets and so on. And it's quite an effort, obviously. And also, these women would have been kind of economically poor, and maybe their health and well-being was not so well developed. So to have to carry those loads was very demanding. And I did some research at the time to find that, yes, the research showed that doing those things by the women would damage their spines. So I think it is possible, you know, to think about that story of the infirm woman, the stooped woman, that her infirmity came from the cultural situation she was put in as a woman, having to carry loads and ends up with a spine like that. And that Jesus, therefore, is addressing not only the story of a single woman with a physical infirmity, but he's also really saying, you know, we have to look at our society and our culture and the roles they're putting women into and the damage that's doing. And so he's really kind of addressing the whole culture and the society, not just one woman with a physical infirmity. There were probably a lot of other women like that at the time. And of course, the synagogue official says, you know, gives out about this and says, you know, to the woman, there are other days for this to be addressed, not today. This is the Sabbath. And Jesus says, no, you feed your animals and give them thirst. You address their thirst as well on the day, the Sabbath day. You don't let them go hungry and don't let them go thirsty. Why would you therefore think of letting a woman with a situation like that be unattended to just because it's the Sabbath day? Now, Ben Witherington makes the point that, you know, in Luke 4, 16 to 20, Jesus makes his mission statement in terms of, I've come to bring good news to the poor, liberty to captives, and to set the oppressed free. And Ben Witherington has made the point that part of setting the oppressed free for Jesus is addressing the situation of women, like the situation of that oppressed woman. And he says in the story, he says, ought we not address this woman's situation on the Sabbath day, because the Sabbath day is precisely also to be about addressing situations of oppression of women. So, you know, there are other stories and so on, but basically I'm just trying to put across there the idea that we have in the biblical Jesus, in these biblical texts, a person really who can be a resource for us to appreciate the dignity and situation of women in our time and to take a transformative stance wherever there is oppression of women.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. How would you best like us to interact with your
presentation? So I just ask a few questions, really. I mean, for example, the United Nations has recently brought out a report saying, you know, at least the 21-22 report, annual report, the United Nations says, you know, that the situation of women, during COVID, they lost a lot more jobs more quickly than men did. They were longer getting back into the employment market. They had to take on a greater level of care and of caregiving in the homes. And also then there was an increase in domestic violence against women during COVID. And this has happened across the world. So there's no doubt that the situation of women in the world today is still a serious one to be addressed. And one question I'd ask would be, you know, where would you see situations of oppression of women which we need to address today? And secondly, how would you see the biblical Jesus I've been talking about as a resource for us to address those situations of oppression in our time, in our society?
We have some volunteers to...
Yeah, so just for purposes of interaction, I'd invite people to respond.
It might be useful for a woman to actually interact first, that might be, yeah.
Yeah.
All right, I'll have a shot. So, Michael, you're wonderful. I've got the technique, and it's great.
Thank you, Stacey.
And to answer your first question with maybe another question is, you know, I'm recently married, thinking about having children, but probably one of the big hesitations is this is going to be a big stoppage to perhaps a career path that I don't see my husband wrestling with. Mm-hmm. So maybe one of the ways that we're able to continue this conversation in society today is how do we still empower women to not have to leave, you know, their career path or be disadvantaged in that way, but can still raise a family and have children without having to take that as a sacrifice for their family? So not to answer the question, but maybe to provide another question.
Right, thanks, Stacey. Yeah, well, you see, I think the story of Jesus and the situation of women is also a story for men to see how women are meant to be treated and that they have to make changes in their lives to enable this to happen. And that's an example, I suppose, where really with your husband, you'd probably want to get into good conversation with him. And if the biblical Jesus can be a support to do that and say, you know, in his time, this was the trajectory he was putting out there. And we now have this situation in our lives as a married couple, and it will mean something for you too if I'm going to be able to have a career path. How can we see together how to do this? And can we find in Jesus and these stories a support if we believe in him as somebody who can guide us and give us strength and courage to make the changes that will be needed?
Thank you. Another comment.
Can I just follow on from that, Michael?
Yeah.
And that is... you brought it down to the personal conversation to happen, but if we go back to the stooped woman and you were drawing attention to the societal changes,
yeah, good.
How can we then take it into that space?
Yes, I suppose we have to find the public spaces for that to be done. I mean, writing and publishing is one way of doing it. If you're in a teaching situation, you can use that opportunity to get it across through your teaching opportunities. I mean, we have to look around and see where in the public spaces are there openings and opportunities, perhaps, to get across this message to a wider public, be it through the media, if we're working in media, for example, or whatever. So I would say to look around and see where are there openings in public spaces for us to kind of get across our message to reach a wider audience and to hopefully then over time bring about change by raising consciousness. And
I would say that women have been trying to do that for centuries.
I know.
So again, how are the men hearing it and how are the societal structures responding?
Surely, we just have to keep persevering, I suppose, you know, and not give up. I know it's very tough, but what is the alternative just to give up and despair? So it is very tough. And that is a good point to ask ourselves, you know, if we're going to get engaged in these struggles, as we are engaged already, what are the resources we need ourselves to be able to do it and to build networks of support for each other to keep going?
Another...
Yeah, just I'm trying to think in a practical vein. Very pretty recently, I have two young kids. It was interesting time to, and I have a lot of friends in academia, young women who are trying to figure out how to move forward. And one of the things that's interesting to me, my wife is a therapist, and got into that through social work. And one of the things that she always laughs about is that in social work, if on your resume You were like a mom for 10 years. Everybody like applauds you and is like, oh, great job. Like, come on back in. You have something valuable to offer. And I wonder, like, especially as we move into places where we're reading CDs and hiring people, is something small we can do? Is like, can we make that a space on a CD where instead of it being like, oh, 10 years we didn't publish, is that something we can say 10 years is something really important and we're going to value that? But I think we're going to have to make really practical things. Like, we're going to have to read CDs differently. Maybe make a space for that.
Mm-hmm.
If we're going to start making change, we're like, that could really matter. So just like a small practical thing.
Yeah.
Read people's life trajectories and maybe learn to value that.
Good. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
If I could be so daring, in Australia, you have two major denominations, the Lutheran Church and the Catholic Church, that still refuse to ordain women. So what about the religious environment?
Yes, I know it's absolutely dreadful that we don't have women able to be ordained in the Catholic Church, my church, and I can't speak so much about the Lutherans. I was talking earlier to Aunt Stacey this morning and saying that for me it's very hard to say public masses because I feel in doing so I'm kind of putting that out there that men can do this and you can't as a woman if you're there. Mm-hmm. And so I resist saying public masses because I don't want to be putting that out that only people like me can be doing this.
Mm-hmm.
And I've written about the situation of the lack of ordination of women in the Catholic Church. So, again, you know, through whatever opportunities I have, through my teaching, my writing, whether I say public masses or not and stuff like that, I'm trying to convey something about this situation. And I'm sure eventually will have to come, you know. You take the resurrection story with Mary of Magdalene. I mean, in the time of Jesus, a woman's word would not be accepted in court because it would not be considered to be sufficiently strong enough. And yet this is the person that Jesus has announcing the resurrection to his disciples. And it's a clear sign again that beyond the historical Jesus and now into the resurrected Christ, we have his desire to see women moving forward into leadership and so on. And therefore, I think it's very, very countercultural, if you like, in relation to Jesus, for the Catholic Church not to kind of move along that path and enable women into leadership at every level in the Catholic Church. And I think eventually it will have to come. And again, a bit like what your question, I myself despair sometimes and you feel like giving up, but we have to keep at it.
We have perhaps one more comment or interaction.
Yeah, it's not so much a question for you, Michael, but it's a question that you've raised for me in relation to my wife. And that we've been married 45 years next month, and we've, you know, 5 kids, 7 grandkids, and so on. But the question is, and you know, when I go home tonight and she asks me how the day was, where I want to go with her is, do you feel empowered?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know the answer to that question, but I think I should find out.
Do you feel empowered?
Wait for my wife and I. Tomorrow you don't get the divorce. But that's for me and for the men who are married and even the men who are not married, Jesus wasn't married. That's the real question. How do we empower and are they empowered, the women in our lives?
Yeah, well, I suppose we have to start by talking with them and seeing how together this could be and step by step move in that direction. The first thing I think for people to have is a desire that change happen and then to see together how to bring it about and to know it's not going to come quickly and easily and to see therefore how to support each other as we do it. But to have the desire, and that's the first step really, because not everybody is looking for this kind of change, and Jesus clearly wanted it. And another thing he wants to say there was in the story of the stooped woman, at the end of that story, you know, Jesus is kind of is regarded as an agitator of the people by the person who invited him to give the teaching, because he's never again asked back to speak in the synagogue, because clearly they felt, look, we can't trust this guy, we invite him in, look what happens, keep him out. And at his trial, he's accused of being an agitator of the people. And the people in that story were all very happy that Jesus took the stance for the stooped woman. So I think that one of the reasons why Jesus was crucified was because of his stance for women and the situation of women and his desire to change it. And, you know, if that's the case, if we're going to take up the same situation, we have to be ready for serious consequences. So how much do we really want it?
Michael, thank you. That's the end of our time. Would you please thank Michael?
Thank you.
Thank you. We can move as quickly as quietly if you need to.
Right, I'll give it to you now. You just get a bit of the attendance here. Right.
Later on.
Is it? Yeah, it's on.
I'm sure. So you're just going to remain sitting here?
Yeah. There's a chair there if somebody needs a chair. There's a chair. An empty chair there.
Religious? Are you in an order, or?
Yeah, I'd say something about that in the talk as well. Yeah, yeah.
Welcome, friends. I think without further ado, I'll introduce to you Bernadette Flanagan, all the way from Ireland. He works at the Southeast Technological University. I think he's a colleague of Michael.
Yeah, work together.
In 2019, she co-edited with Professor Laszlo Zolonai, Radley's International Handbook of Spirituality in Society and the Professions. Currently, she is working with Professor Kerry Klo to produce the Routledge Handbook of Research Methods in Spirituality and Contemplative Studies. And she's going to address the topic, how do we embody new life and bring to fruition the gifts we are given? Would you please welcome to Australia and to the forum.
Okay, if I sit, can you hear me? Or is it better?
It's just recording, it's not actually.
Okay. So the topic for the conference, as you know, is Christian spirituality as a pathway for the modern seeker. So when I got the title, it drew me into reflecting on the conversations I have with students. And in the conversation with the students that I meet, they're particularly interested about what practices assist on the pathway. And in Ireland, I suppose at this time, a practice that's really emerging is very significant is the practice of pilgrimage. I suppose we're a society on the move. We have had one kind of cultural, spiritual reality, social reality, and we're moving. Where are we going? You know, it's a little bit like that tale, where are you going? Away from here, away from here, away from here. So we're society on the move, and that's incarnated in the rise of pilgrimage within Ireland. So we have a National Pilgrimage Day. We have a flourishing network of pilgrimage paths that are ever expanding. One of my PhD students is working on developing 4 new micro pilgrimage paths, because the kind of pilgrimage paths that are there tend to be long trekking routes, and they're not always suitable for people with disabilities, for people who are bringing children, people who have limited time. So the whole area of how do we develop the practice of pilgrimage as a spiritual practice for today is coming out of my particular cultural context. But this is a global reality as well, because I am part of some of the global pilgrimage networks. And what strikes me is when I go to these networks, there's loads of tourism scholars, anthropology scholars, history scholars, marketing scholars, every kind of a scholar, and I'm usually the only spirituality scholar in the room. So why is the spiritual practice of pilgrimage so poorly known or not really developed as a conversation piece in our work as spirituality scholars. So what I have been doing is looking at some of the practice of pilgrimage in the spiritual tradition and see what can we learn for that as I stand in front maybe of a set of tourism scholars or marketing scholars. What is pilgrimage to say to people in these kind of settings as a spiritual practice? So as you can see from the descriptor that I put in the handbook, there are three particular pilgrimages from the tradition that I have selected. So I mightn't take them in the order of the handbook because maybe I'll start with my own setting, the Irish setting, and the particular pilgrim story that I'm select for conversation, in particularly if with people from a business background, is the Menina story. And they find her story of pilgrimage very interesting. So Menina is one of the four great abbesses of Ireland. So four of the abbesses established monastic foundations, centres of learning, essentially. We're dealing with a pre-urban culture. So if you want to provide healing and if you want to grow food and teach children, and that kind of thing, these monastic centres in our setting were the kind of gatherings where these things happened. So Menina is one of the four women who established these very notable settings towards the, up towards the north of Ireland. And it's really interesting to see how did she go about setting up her spiritual enterprise. So it's a learning about the establishment of enterprises today. And what happened was there were a couple of like-minded people who were seeing these developments of learning centres, local learning centres, healing centres, centres of refuge, all around the country. They had relations who had gone out, mostly men who had gone out and done this. So how were they as a group of women going to do this? And how they went about preparing themselves for setting up this new enterprise that they were going to do was by going on a pilgrimage together. So we have a record from her life of this pilgrimage that she did, where she went to three centres. So she went over to the west coast of Ireland, onto the Aran Islands, if any of you have been there, and there was a person who was a relation of hers who had established one of these enterprises. Ibar had established it on the Aran Islands, and she spent time with him looking at, you know, choosing a very isolated setting. Is that what she needed to choose? Is that the best place to establish her kind of enterprise? Having spent some months with Ibar, she crossed from the west coast and an island isolated location right into the centre of the country, where we have quite a different enterprise. We have Bridget at work in the centre of the country, and Bridget is in a very agricultural area, and the whole mythology around Bridget with the extension of her cloak is the whole thing of the development of the land and the provision of food and abundance, milk and honey, and all of these kind of food products are part of her the mythology of her story. So we get this sense, maybe she's called to establish something that's going to be agricultural, that reaches people in that particular way. And having spent the group having spent their internship with Bridget, they finally moved to a third setting where there's a school. So maybe the enterprise is called to education. So she moves down to Beggary Island in Wexford, and that's a school location where she does an internship there. So she goes on a pilgrimage to three places with this group of people with whom she's going to establish her monastic enterprise. And out of that, she chooses the educational enterprise. And it's an educational enterprise that she establishes in Killeavy. So it's a whole way of establishing an enterprise together, that the people do a journey and look at some things that are happening in other places and do learning together. So you have that collaborative learning enterprise. So it's not one person drawing up a strategic plan on their own and everybody just following the direction that's set. So that's Menina in terms of pilgrimage practice teaches us something about collaborative learning and collaborative enterprise. The second person that I wanted to look at was Egeria, much earlier story of pilgrimage. So it's this story of a woman from north Spain, south of France, not particularly clear where it is. But it's the very early days of Christianity. Constantine's mother has gone to Jerusalem, the Holy Land. She's been supported by Constantine economically and through his political links to find the holy sites. in that area and begin to develop these holy sites, mark them, make them known, put buildings on those sites which would enable them to be preserved. So Ejiri is there, and she wants to get in touch. You know, like with contemporary spiritual teachers, it's often attractive to go and stay with the teacher in the particular place where they teach. So Ejiri heads to the Holy Land. But what's interesting for when you look at her story of Ejiri's journey, pilgrimage to the Holy Land, is that she doesn't focus so much on the new buildings that are being put up. You know, following on from Helena's enterprise. Instead, she focuses on one of the communities that's trying to carry forward the spirit of the Jesus mission, very much in line with what Michael was saying. This is the Thekla community. So in the Thekla community, who was a collaborator of Paul, as you know, we very much find that kind of mission of Jesus to women being carried forward and being expressed in new and diverse ways. So what Ejiri wants to contact is, you know, the communities that follow in the spirit of Thekla. What are they doing? And so we get very elaborate descriptions within her pilgrimage narrative of what it is like to be welcomed into those communities and to find women that find a way of carrying forward the gospel experience into their own setting. We're talking about Turkey, over that direction where the Thekla followers were particularly strong. So there's a second purpose of pilgrimage. It helps us get in touch with the original enterprise. It helps us touch into maybe the founding story of something that we're part of. So in my own case, I'm a presentation sister. The foundress is an Irish woman. It's the first of the Irish religious institutes who lived in Cork under the penal law. So it wasn't possible for anybody to have public practice of religion. But in an students, yeah, she established these underground schools. And today you can go and you can walk the path that she did every day between these seven underground enterprises. And it, you know, sparks your imagination. What would an underground enterprise look like today? So whether it's Thekla for Ejiri or Nanonagel for myself, I suppose, there's this thing of just going back to the roots and walking these original roots, whatever they are in our own local setting, whether they're already marked or they're unmarked. That's part of what pilgrimage offers us as a spiritual practice. And the third woman that I look at then is Marjorie Kemp, which is the place of pilgrimage in life transitions. So Marjorie Kemp's two chapters of life, you know, up to becoming a wife and mother, and then the second chapter of her life, 13 children, two enterprises, very, very busy woman, had a very difficult experience around her first birth, and out of that had a mystical, a spiritual experience that awakened in her a sense there's something beyond the everyday that's happening here. In these physical realities of my life, I'm touching into a mystery. But there was little time to explore it. So when she came to midlife, she made a covenant with her husband that she would go on pilgrimage. And in the whole pilgrimage of Marjorie Kemp, we find a story of somebody using the practice of pilgrimage in order to explore a new chapter that's opening in life. So it's quite personal for Marjorie, the particular way that she uses practice. So three different windows on pilgrimage. The first one with Manina, pilgrimage is a way into collaborative enterprise. Whether we're in a school community, whatever kind of community, nursing community, it may offer a shared spiritual practice. The second one then is pilgrimage as an opportunity to touch into a founding energy. If we want to recapture and be re-energized by a founding vision, pilgrimage provides us with that opportunity through the story of Ejiri. And thirdly, through Marjorie Kemp, we get this sense of pilgrimage as a practice that can bring us through a life transition. We walk the change we're making. Okay, thank you very much. Thank you.
How would you like us to... we can applaud.
Okay.
How would you like us to interact with your presentation?
Well, I have a reflective page to hand out first, maybe. I'll just hand this around. Just to do something different.
Mm. so beautifully summarised. Thank you.
Not at all. So that's for yourself. It's an adapted saying from John of the Cross. To get to an unknown land by unknown roads, a traveller cannot allow himself or herself to be guided by an old experience. She or he has to doubt himself, herself, and seek the guidance of others. There is no way she or he can reach the new territory and know it truly unless unless she abandons familiar roads. So, you know, the question for yourself, what unknown land may be beckoning or what outward action might initiate the journey? So there is something to take away, but I'm happy to take a couple of questions without that.
And who'd like to initiate an interaction?
I'm not sure if I've formulated the question yet, but, Europe has got lots of traditional Christian pilgrimage paths. Australia is, post 1788 white settlement and Christianity. Mm. So we have some places which might be significant in terms of our Christian religious history. We have a much more ancient, the country is absolutely covered in pilgrimage and song lines. Mm. I have lots of friends who head off to Europe to do their pilgrimage. Mm. It feels somehow not quite right to me.
That's right.
It's exotic and lovely, but how can it tell us about being in this place?
Yeah.
So, interestingly, I just happened to be driving from Melbourne up to here and came a little bit via the coast and went to Panola, and it was a sort of random choice. Like there, it was a rainy day. Who wants to go on a winery on a wine, in the middle of winter anyway? But so we head to Panola instead. And I'm thinking, this is a really significant pilgrimage destination. But you can't walk it. It was a good experience while I was there. But I guess I've just got this wondering about. For us living in this continent, what pilgrimage looks like.
Yeah, that's the question I'm trying to promote. So we're not. So the PhD student I'm working with is not working on four paths that are there already. Yeah. We're working on trying to create new paths that are more, because these, often these advertised pilgrimage routes or prominent pilgrimage routes are really hikes, and you do need health, energy, time, and finances to do them. So how can the spiritual practice of pilgrimage be redeveloped and reimagined in a way which addresses all of those kind of issues and becomes more localised, given the questions of sustainability that we must look at today as well.
I believe there is a pilgrimage to Panola coming out of Victoria. So someone's actually leading that. Someone else, up the back there. Thank you.
Just bouncing off the need for health and finance to do the hikes the pilgrimage, are you finding there are ways where people can be pilgrims together without the physical movement, but can people read along together? Is there a inner journey?
Yes, there are finger pilgrimages being developed in the way that maybe people follow a text together, or it's a kind of an adaptation of Lectio Divina, with people finding their finger resting on a particular space within the text, or somebody may be sick within the community and may only be able to walk their own back garden or something like that, and other people walking the back garden with them. There's a pilgrimage scholar in the United States, Catherine Baruch, and she's written an amazing story of a man who couldn't get to the Camino because of a cancer diagnosis, and how the pilgrimage became his own back garden, and she accompanied him for those final months in his own back garden. So it's been reimagined in lots of ways. Catherine Baruch is a wonderful scholar of the reimagination of pilgrimage in local settings, and they can become spiritual practices of protest as well. So climate activists are taking pilgrimages to sites which are being lost because of the environmental degradation and what's happening today. So there, one of the students on the MA, do you want to? Yeah, she's
Petra's from Croatia.
The budget in Croatia, where she was from, was being reduced for children's health. And so there was a man whose child had a serious condition which needed to be treated, but because of the way the national budget was being organised, the child couldn't get the treatment. So for Holy Week, he did a pilgrimage from his own village to the Parliament buildings carrying the cross. That was his protest or use of pilgrimage to address the local budget in Croatia. So it can be very powerful as well and socially, and it gathered a huge crowd because of the time of the year that it was in Croatia. Yeah.
Mm. Oh, no, thank you.
In part of the pilgrimages of transformation, of protest, is transformation still at the heart of the pilgrimage?
What's been looked at more today is what happens in the process of pilgrimage rather than what is the destination of pilgrimage. And so various, whether it's courage is being developed, whether it's resilience, whether it's transformation, various qualities of human personhood can be developed. Or entrepreneurship, courage, all of those kind of things. So it varies the kind of quality, and that's probably a conversation that it would take place at the beginning of a pilgrimage. So pilgrimages today usually have built into them more of a process, these kind of new pilgrimages, a process for starting and ending the pilgrimage together and gathering whatever the fruits of the experience, setting intention at the beginning and gathering the fruits at the end. Yeah.
Someone else?
In the States, of course, we have all these hikes like the Appalachian Trail. And those who do it have various reasons for doing it. I imagine many are doing it as a faith-based experience. But bringing Mary Froelich's talk into conversation with yours, it just strikes me in a postmodern, sort of post-Christian context, how we can reinterpret these long hikes.
I mean, that's what the radio, you know, there are lots of interviews now happening in Ireland. Why are all these people climbing Kirkpatrick, which is quite a difficult climb to do? And you find this kind of underlying anonymous spiritual interpretation happening. I'm doing it because my brother has an addiction that he's trying to recover from or whatever it. So there's a lot of work to be done in terms of finding the language to connect with the contemporary pilgrim that is able to find that spiritual longing that's often there in the narrative that drives the person. Yeah. Thanks, Brad. Yeah. Okay, thank you.
One more? We have time for one more.
Thank you for your book so much. I'm curious, did you find in your research a link between a pilgrimage that someone embarks on and their sense of belonging to that place?
That can be an element of, I mean, many people come to Ireland on pilgrimage because they have Irish roots. So, yeah, sometimes that is part of what drives the pilgrimage. But other thing, this is one of the discoveries. It's less about destination today and more about process in the research of, see, even if you just look at the books that people are publishing on pilgrimage today, of which there are thousands, apart from blogs and other sources online kind of thing, that the focus has turned inwards, perhaps, in the pilgrim journey rather than the outward achievement. Yeah.
I was curious because of James' comment about the lack of pilgrimages here in Australia.
Yeah.
And I was curious to see, I wonder if that's our sense of belonging on this land.
Maybe,
is there something in that might
give
us?
It'll be interesting.
The pilgrimage here
That might be it. Very interesting question. Yeah.
So that's,
thanks, Milly. Thank you.
Well, the movement that's happening in the room, which I think is unfortunate, but it's what it is.
Yeah.
But would you please thank Bernadette Rowman?
Thank you.
We'll commence again. And the topic for this afternoon is how to catch courage from a beginning. Over to you, Kathy. Thank you.
Thank you. So I just want to begin my presentation by maybe addressing some questions that you may have come with about this topic, how to catch courage from a beginning. And so the questions I'm just going to briefly address before going into how do you catch courage are these. courage in the face of what? How is courage defined? And who on earth are the Beguines? So just to address these very briefly here. So perhaps another way to ask this question of courage in the face of what is, why do women need courage? And we've sort of touched on that a little bit with some of the presentations before. So to provide a very brief answer, I'll go to James Fowler, who I'm sure many of you are familiar with, and his theory of faith development, which was back in the 80s and has been developed and critiqued since, that people, as they develop in their faith, they move in their locus of authority, where their locus of authority is. And between stage 3 and 4, there is a shift from an external locus of authority to an internal locus of authority. And so today in the church, still very much a patriarchal institution, it affords women very little authority. And therefore, as women develop in their faith and learn to trust their own spiritual authority, it takes courage to present a different voice to the dominant masculine culture. In the past, this may have resulted in accusations of heresy or burning at the stake. Although situations have changed a lot since the 13th century, women today still find that they need great courage to find their own voice and speak out in their communities. So how is courage defined? I think our ideals of courage are often shaped by the predominant stories of our cultures, which uphold the archetypal image of a hero. This view of courage portrays strength and power. But this is not the type of courage that I'm speaking about in this paper. Rebecca Conindyke de Young, I think that's how you pronounce her name, has talked about a different type of courage that's born out of love and vulnerability. She looks at the courageous characters in the Harry Potter series, which some of you may be familiar with, and observes that the masculine, militaristic models of courage are challenged by women, children, and the physically weak. Rather than displaying courageous aggression, they portray courageous endurance. This is the type of courage displayed by the Beguines that was caught by the contemporary women in my research. So, who are the Beguines? Some of you may be familiar with them. The Beguines were a lay movement of women that arose in the 13th century. And at a time when women had a choice of either marrying or entering a religious order, these women chose a third radical way. They often lived in community together, but did not take vows and could choose to leave at any time. At the start of the 13th century, they were praised as pious examples of religious women. But by the middle of the century, the church hierarchy had become suspicious of them and they began to be suppressed. The Beguines shared of their mystical experiences of God, and some even wrote them down. They wrote in the vernacular language of their area rather than Latin, and their work was shared. The fate of the Beguines is probably exemplified mostly in the story of Marguerite Perret, whose books were burned, and then she kept disseminating them around the place, and eventually she was burnt at the stake in 1310 as a relapsed heretic. So they're the background questions to begin with. So how do we catch courage from a Beguine? Well, these conclusions have come from my recent research where I introduced a group of contemporary women to the works of three Beguines. So as Hadwig of Brabant, Mechtild of Magdeburg and Marguerite Perret. And then I gathered their responses to their engagement with the Beguines, and it's highlighted four ways that they caught courage from these women. So these are the four ways here that I'll go through. So the first way is the performative and transformative nature of the Begin texts themselves. Most of the women in my study group found that their engagement with the Begins was transformative for them. So here we've got a quote from Faye, who said, "I would sit down with each of these three women and listen to their wisdom and be encouraged by them to grow in my relationship with God in a way that feels fulsome and acknowledges the feminine." So Faye's experience was very much that she wanted to engage more with this, the works of the Beguines. The work of... the work of Mary Sydenham, a scholar in medieval mysticism, supports this. She argues that the Beguine texts were never intended to be simply private revelations, but were intended to invoke a transformative power for generations of readers. So, for example, this is what Alice said from my study group. She said, "It struck me very forcibly. I'm being so tentative about what I say and do in relation to the church. She," and she's talking about Marguerite Perret here, "she just lived it and said it like it was for her, with that sense of inner authority. And she lost her life for it. And I thought, well, I'm not going to do that. The most I'm going to do is get criticism or stuff like, you still going to church then?" So I was very, very struck by her courage. So this first way that courage was caught from the Beguines by these women was the performative and transformative nature of the texts themselves. The second way was a dialogue with the texts. So the two of the women described that they actually entered into a dialogue as they were reading the texts of the Beguines. And historian Carr said history is an unending dialogue between past and present. The fact that the contemporary women were invited into a contemplative reading of the text also shifted the emphasis and brought in the third dimension of the Spirit, the Holy Spirit. Scott Ellington, writing about a Pentecostal hermeneutic of Scripture, says that Spirit-led reading adds a measure of shared experience between the author and the hearer. The exchange between these women, centuries apart, exceeded the contribution of the author and the reader. So a contemplative reading of the text began a dialogue that allowed the contemporary women to catch courage from the Beguines with all of that time in between. The third way was exemplars laying the path, and a couple of the women talked in these terms. They described that the Beguines had laid a path before them. And Nicola Slee, in her work around women's faith development, talks about personalised faithing, where women articulate their faith with reference to spiritual exemplars. She describes how women enshrine faith in a human other. For the contemporary women in my study, the Beguines embodied the courage and the authenticity that they desired for themselves. So Christine from my study group explained it like this. "It was like the path ahead of me felt dark and I couldn't see it. And then I met these women and I was like, oh, you've trodden this path. There's a path here that I can actually tread." Seeing the Beguines as exemplars who had gone before them allowed the contemporary women to catch their courage. And the final way that the contemporary women were able to catch courage from the Beguines was beautifully summarised by Alice. She said, "I don't know what I believe about heaven or the communion of saints, but in a sense the voices are still there. The spirit of the Beguine movement is still there, and to rehear them seems like a lovely honouring of what they gave to us." So I used some of Elizabeth Johnson's feminist interpretation of the communion of saints, which asserts that that if this deep connection with those who've gone before us is to continue, it must be pervaded with a larger historical solidarity. And this includes the Beguines. and avoids them just becoming a pile of victims. And she's very, very clear, however, to emphasise that we don't enter into their struggles from the past, but continue our struggles in solidarity with them. So just to sum up, whoops, there's that quote. These are the four ways that the women showed me that they caught courage from the Beguines and their engagement with their texts.
Thank you. How would you like us to engage with you?
I have a couple of questions for you.
Good.
So are there other examples of virtues? So we've talked about courage today. Are there other examples of virtues which you feel could be contagious from historical figures? And what has been your experience of that? And how does your experience resonate or differ to the contemporary women in this study? Are there other ways that you have caught virtues from historical figures from engaging with their writings?
We'd like to volunteer a response.
Yes.
And that's what, yeah, that's what helps me take it away rather than just be like, oh, that was writing.
Yeah. I think it went hand in hand here that because when I introduced the Beguines to the women, I started with their story and who they were and that sort of thing, as much as we know, of course, because we don't know a lot. And so when they went to the writings, it was knowing that story that was behind it. And actually quite a few of them said, I'd love to know more about them. I want to know who they are. And one woman said, like, I don't even care if the story's made up. I just want to know the story, you know, like she... And it, so I found that really interesting that, you know, someone could just embellish it, but she... The story was very important. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I just had a question like over Margaret Corrett. Just because her theology is so radically apophatic, her theology of annihilation, I think can be quite dangerous. I've actually written some stuff on this. So I'm just wondering if you came across the potential dangers in her writing in particular, not the others, but hers.
I think that the language issue, I mean, the word annihilation itself is problematic. What I found with the women when I asked them how they responded to that, they found contemporary language to describe what they thought she was talking about. So, for example, some of them talked about, you know, the true self and the false self and ridding yourself of, you know, and so that they used contemporary authors to sort of try and explain what they thought she meant rather than really engaging. It was interesting to see in that instance in particular, that's what they tended to do. Yeah.
Mm. Some of the texts speak about dancing, in the Beguines text about dancing. And I think it's I find that a very positive view. And so in my meditation time, there is a sense of dancing going on. Or that sentence from T.S. Eliot, in the stillness is the dancing. So I think to have that idea of the spirit dancing in the silence of the meditator.
Yes. And I think that alternative language, like the very feminine sort of language that came through, really appealed to the women. You know, different images for God and, you know, all of that sort of thing was really appealing and gave permission, empowered them to be able to use their own images as well. Thank you.
I had the pleasure of studying Hadamik, and I'm just really interested, did you kind of go with courage as a theme before you started, or was that something that came out of the...
Yeah, no, it just emerged, really, as one of the strongest things that came. Another thing that came through, which is not a virtue as such, but was validation. The women felt validated by their experience of God, was validated by reading these women. So, courage just emerged quite strongly through it. Mm.
I was just going to say, your first question there about other historical figures, the Beguines and how my experience of the desert forebears and the virtues they encourage of humility and purity of heart, that I found that really contagious, and that your four ways that I caught that are quite similar pathways, even though it's a different virtue. And I think what's common is that when we see examples of historical figures who've given their lives to something and they've developed a virtue through the course of a pathway in their life, then observing that without our risk, us having to risk our whole life for that particular thing, we observe the fruit, and then we're encouraged to bear that virtue by taking the same path, essentially.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah.
I'm just fascinated by a couple of the remarks about story and the power of story, and thinking about the desert stories, how they often in front of the text, you know, in front of the events. My own experience of reading Anne of Green Gables at the age of 10, and like, really finding her captivating. Are there other ways of engaging with the you worked with text, but I think the telling of story and the telling of story that relates virtues to lived experience is one of the things that I think it would be great to see more work done on.
Yes.
To see more work of that done.
Yeah, I've been, since I finished my PhD, I've been reading a lot of historical fiction, which I love, and I've been thinking, oh, wouldn't it be great, like, I don't think I'm the person to do it, but if someone, you know, did write a story about one of the Beguines and just, fleshed it out and made it, because that was what, two women said the same thing, I want more flesh on the bones, that's what they said, and because we don't have a lot of information, we don't have a lot of biographical information, we have only got what we can glean from the texts and things, and it was like the women wanted to get to know them as people, you know, and have that relationship, and you can only go so far, you know, when you're reading the text, so yeah, definitely.
Can I just say to that? Susan Shooter might be writing about Margaret.
She is, yeah. She's written about women who've experienced abuse.
She's actually looking at writing a
novel. Oh, right. Yeah, she did mention that to me when I saw her, actually. Yes, yeah. That's good.
Following on from Amy's. I'm just wondering whether it would be worth going back to the four ways of catching that you had there, and whether in fact that would apply to any virtue, those same ways of catching, and another PhD in there.
Well, that's right. That's right.
How your framework can apply to.
Well, that's the question I'm asking, really. I'd love to hear other people's experience around that, and yeah, so that would be great.
Well, it's not one or two more.
I think
we'll go that way.
I'll just say quickly. I think for me, when I look back at historical figures, we had a bit earlier Michael's thing about how we're not giving to despair, and I think that there is something for me about seeing the amazing things that people have done, the changes that have been made, but also the perseverance is a virtue for you. The perseverance just to keep things on going.
And I think that's what a lot of the women noticed. They said, gosh, they gave their life, well, with Marguerite, you know, she gave her life up for this. And like Alice said, you know, I'm not going to have to do that. I just have to cop a bit of criticism, that's all. So, that's right.
Okay, I like your point there about ways to be courageous. And I was thinking too of Jesus being courageous to be vulnerable. You know, the story with Mary of Bethany near the Last Supper, he is obviously very aware that his death could happen, as he would be when you're in a situation where you've been taking stands and you're seeing reactions and you know that your baby's getting dangerous and so on. And at that time, she wept tears at his feet and dried them with her hair. And afterwards, you know, he's been in a vulnerable state there, and she reaches into him at that time when he needs some support of that kind. But in the Last Supper, then afterwards, with the washing of the feet, you know, she was somebody I think who who would have watched you speak when he came to her house, the house of Ezra to Martha, her sister, and he would have had that experience of having his feet washed by her. And when he wants to sort of reach out to his disciples at a time when he's very vulnerable near his death and probably worried something's going to happen, the way he expresses his feelings for them is to wash their feet. And I would say that Mary of Bethany probably had a big influence on him, and that she's present in the Last Supper as certainly as somebody who is working through him to express himself in this way with his disciples. And it's an example of how the vulnerable Jesus has learned from a woman and expresses what he's learned from her towards his disciples.
Yeah, thank you.
Would you please thank Kathy?
Thank you.
I think we're pretty well on time, so have enjoyed the lunch.
Thank you.